Yeah, Peter Alcoholic. Member of the East End group in St. Catharines, Ontario. It's a good time to be sober, I tell you. My group has been going since 1951, and there's quite a few groups in the Niagara area that are 75, 76 years of having the doors open. I'm alcoholic by my admission, not by your admission. That's the funny thing. I heard one lady say that, and that stuck with me because nobody can pin it on you here. I'm not here by accident. I'm born and raised 200 miles north of Toronto, and I come from a good alcoholic home, a very functioning alcoholic home. In the beginning, I'll be 70 years old in May, and so I sobered up when I was 23 years old. And I stay sober, and that's a miracle in itself. I shouldn't be alive. I shouldn't be alive. But anyways, I got three younger brothers, all alcoholics, both my parents, a couple uncles, a grandfather. And so some people say they don't have any alcoholism in their family. We had a herd of alcoholics, and most of them are sober today. Now, some of them are not going to meetings, but that's not my business. I'm not a highly educated alcoholic. My alcoholism took my education away. I don't know how you fail grade three. I don't know how you do that, and I wasn't drinking. And I love the humor of Alcoholics Anonymous, where they said we're not a glum lot. We can have fun in sobriety, and I had a lot of fun growing up as a kid. I played hockey, pond hockey, and that's what I'm doing now, but it's in a rink. But the idea is, as kids, our parents were able to supply us equipment, and we played hockey and baseball in the summer, so it was a good upbringing in the sense that my parents, as I know it today, did the best they could with what they had. You only do what you know. And in those days, people drank on the job. People smoked in the offices. They probably smoked in the operating room as a kid. I never smoked cigarettes. I smoked one cigarette in my life, and it almost killed me. It was an export plane, and I tried to smoke it right down, and that fixed me. And I'm not saying I didn't smoke. I smoked a lot of drugs, and I just mentioned that I'm an alcoholic, druggie, and I just mentioned it because alcohol is a drug, and I sobered up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never had a problem saying that I was an alcoholic slash whatever. And my dry date is the last time I did drugs, but that doesn't matter. We're here because of alcoholism. And so anyways, I believe I always equate my family disease with food, because it was when we were young kids, we used to eat steaks that were 2 inches thick, the big sirloin steaks, and we were living high on the hog. My parents bought a brand new house in North Bay. My dad had a brand new car every year. He had no education, my dad, but he could sell. He could sell ice to the Eskimos, and that he had a gift. And most alcoholics are very gifted people, but we misuse our gifts. And so my dad was able to provide a good living for us. But near the end of their drinking, as a young kid, we ate Kraft dinner, and we didn't know if we were going to eat from day to day. And so that was the relationship with food, because it was like I always thought it was poor people that weren't able to eat. And I always thought that alcoholism, my parents' alcoholism, was weakness. And I thought, why don't you just get your shit together? You'll be fine. And well, anyways, I started drinking. My thing, the only reason I went to school was because of sports, because I could play my hockey. And near the end of my drinking, I quit hockey, I quit going to school. I went to work for a bit, and I found out, oh my God, I don't want to do be a labor or whatever, do this terrible job that I was doing. So I went back to school as a young kid, 16, 17 years old, and but I didn't play any hockey because I was what they call on a dry drunk. I put the cork in the jug for 11 months at 19 years old, and I tried to control my drinking and drugging and all the things that go with it. And I found out that social drinkers don't go on the wagon. They don't do that. But I was 11 months sober and on my own, and but I was not happy, joyous, or free. I was a very miserable guy, and I did well in school, but because I was applying myself. You can't go to school high and drunk, and I lost a lot of I jokingly brain cells because of that, and I getting sober, I found out we're not dumb people, but if sober, we can apply ourselves, and so my drinking took me to places where they had lower companions, and in Alcoholics Anonymous it said, what happens if you become the lower companion? What happens, you go into a bar and somebody, the sunlight comes into the bar and they yell out, close the door, because the sunlight is coming into the bar. That's messed up. And I was all dressed up heading down to Skid Row, and this little bars that I drank in, you wouldn't even take your dog to them, but you drank in these places. And there's a couple bars that were off the grid. Everything and anything could happen. And I heard a couple of years later that the place burned down, and I had nothing to do with it. And but anyways, I'm drinking in these places, and I'm trying to do the best I can with what I know. I don't know that I was so resentful and angry, because for me, like most people, alcohol is a social lubricant. It makes you feel better. You're part of, but even back then, I didn't feel part of. I was a bar hopper. I was always discontented where I was, and it could be better with this bar or with this woman or whatever. And so I heard a bunch of guys talking about Europe and how and Eastern Asia or something like that, and they planted the seed. Because I wanted to get out of this little town that I lived in, and every corner I turned on, I had bad memories and bad feelings, and anyways, I got it in my head that I'm going to go to Europe and travel a bit, and I got some money together, and I landed in Amsterdam in 1976, and Canada was on the map. The World Olympics were going on. I turned 21 years older in Berlin, in Germany, and Berlin still had the Berlin Wall around it, and I drank my way through Europe. One t time I would be in a nice hotel, hostel, and the next minute I'm sleeping on the street in the bush someplace because I'm just so wasted. And but that's the crazy thing about my drinking. I always kind of had money. That was the only thing I could control. And if you have to try to control it, it's out of control. And yeah, so I went up to as far north as Copenhagen, down to Greece, and I seen a lot of history, and I love history. I seen the things that you could only read about and talk about, and so I wasn't drunk out of my mind all the time, but I was drunk. I had the drunken attitude. I would sit in a church. I grew up in church, and I always had a sense of that's where you went for peace of mind. And I'd sit in a church and try to figure out where I was going and what I'm doing, and somebody would yell out, "Put some money in the thing as you leave, buddy." And they said it to everybody. It turned me off. Here I'm trying to be spiritual and They're trying to grind me for money. Anyway, I had to share that because it's a I had a good heart, but my mind was messed up, and so was my heart. I know that now. But everywhere I went, I brought Peter. I thought I left those losers behind in Canada, and so I found out that I was a common denominator everywhere I went. It wasn't the people there, it was me. And I spent 2.5 months, 3 months traveling in Europe, and I came back to Canada, and I almost kissed the ground. I had a bit of gratitude because, the food in those days was overflowing. Gas was cheap. People were driving these big boats around, and I had a sense of gratitude, like, wow, how fortunate we are here, North America, that we can. We're spoiled. We like to bitch and complain about things sometimes, and we're very fortunate. I had that sense of, but I didn't have the tools to hold on to that gratitude. In hindsight, I can say that now. And so I came back to Canada, and I got a job working in on a construction site, and somebody told me about it, and I don't know who it was and how I got there. I had hair down to my shoulders, and I still had the big beard and my mustache, and anyways, the big guy, my God, as I understand him, set me up. Now, my higher power didn't just start working because I got sober. I know that the big guy was around looking after Peter, looking, trying to. I think, I don't know if God prays for his alcoholics or what, but I have a sense that. He was trying to help me out, and yeah, I got this job, and it was on a psych hospital. Like, this was like a One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest hospital. Like, it was a massive place, a lot of crazy people there. But I'm working on the place, and I felt very uncomfortable there because everybody had a set of keys but me, and that's a scary proposition. In hindsight, but anyways, I'm drinking, and I'm a good worker. I showed up, did the job, and the guy could see that I was I had no experience, but we're not dumb people. We could do some things, and so I ended up getting the guy offered me a job downtown Toronto, and I ended up working there as a steeplejack, working high rise off of a bungee cable hanging off the outside of a building, and I have no fear of heights. I had a fear of living. I know that now, and but I it was not. I know how to make money. I know how to do things, but it was that was short-lived because when I drank, I never knew what was going to happen. I loved you or I hated you. There was no black and white, and I was alone in the big city and. The bright lights, and in those days, yeah, you weren't allowed to drink on Sundays. They had ladies and escorts. Anyways, I remember as a young guy, just thinking back how good it was as a kid. I'm drinking in a small little bar, and for $2, you could fill the tray full for $2. It was 10 cents a draft, and I'm going. How good is that as an alky, right? But anyways, I end up in the big city, and I had some opportunities. I made some good money. It was seasonal for me at that time, and I was okay with that. Again, the traveling was part of my alcoholism because it'll be different in this part of the country. And I went down to Florida with a buddy. We were making our way to South America. We got some a bean brain happening, and we're gonna get some money together. And we took a rent a car. They paid us to take it to Florida, and they ended up hitchhiking through Texas. And I was sleeping on the streets in Florida. And I look back now, I could have been gator bait. In hindsight, I look back at that. I guess I had the money, but I was poor. I don't know how to explain that. There are guys that in Canada here, and some women, probably like in the States, they push the grocery carts And that's the only thing I didn't push was a cart, but I would my alcoholism took me to the street. And but anyways, we made it to Mexico City, and I actually slept one night on the streets of Mexico. Like that's messed up. But I'm how old am I there? I'm 21 years old, 22 years old, and I have a sense of things aren't right. I'm trying to make things happen. I'm trying to change things. We talk about change in Alcoholics Anonymous. I changed a lot of things drunk. I changed everything outside of Peter. I changed women, jobs, provinces, countries. I changed everything, but I never changed Peter. And we in the big book, it talks about why must every alcoholic hit a bottom? And I know now that when we get beaten enough, we become maybe a little more teachable. And I look at my higher power, God, as sitting there saying, Peter, I was waiting for you. Now we can talk. And that's how my relationship with my higher power is. It's a little personal in the sense that my God needed help in the beginning because my God was not very healthy. My God, I think he needed treatment. He was messed up because it wasn't healthy. My God had a 30-odd six, and he was giving it to me all the time. I felt, and but I never took any ownership of my side of the street, of course. But anyways, my mom sobered up 40. Well, she would have been probably 50 years sober now. She sobered up in 1975, and she sobered up with my younger brother. He was 15 years old, and he was a druggie, alcoholic, a huffer. He huffed gasoline, Varsol. He did shit like the young guys do today on fentanyl and this stuff like that. But he sobered up with my mom, and he stayed sober for a year, and I seen the change in the two of them. Now my dad was still drinking back then, but he was a blackout drunk like myself, and he had no problem. But anyways, my I seen the change in my family, and that was the introduction of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom, she went to meetings and volunteered at a treatment facility, and it was AA orientated, and she helped out and volunteered, and one day they hired her. That's how they get rid of you. They hire you. And she ended up working in that treatment center for 22 years, one day at a time. And she died 48 years sober. Now, she was still a little crazy, my mom, in a healthy way, but she was sober. And for me, that's Alcoholics Anonymous, that we're not a glum lot. We can trudge the road. My dad finally got sober, but he never came to AA. He didn't, he looked down on the alcoholic. And I did also, but I went to treatment, and I had a spiritual awakening in the treatment center. I heard a voice, and the voice said, "Peter, you're an alcoholic," and I was transformed. I broke down crying. If you tell people you're hearing voices, they walk away, but in Alcoholics Anonymous, they can say that. But I never told anybody that because I didn't know what really had had to happen. When you have something like that, it's hard to explain. Like when you come off the street and you're messed up. But anyways, it changed me because I knew at that moment in my heart and head that I had to be at AA. I just like, I know where to go. And I went to my first meeting in North Bay. And I couldn't tell you what was said. It was a speaker meeting, but I knew I had to be here, and that was the beginning of my journey. And I told people that story because I really didn't know how to explain it. Not a lot of people talked about people hearing voices in AA. Now, Dr. Carl Jung talked about that We have to be transformed. We have to have a psychic change. And so the dots became connected in my living and in hearing the about alcoholism. And in that same treatment center, I seen a chart called the Jelinek chart. And this chart gave the progression of alcoholism. And I seen in the chart that if you have blackouts in your drinking, that means you're a chronic alcoholic. And it was like, nobody pointed that out to me, but I just seen it on the wall and I did the math. So the dots were being connected, and I didn't think I was a chronic alcoholic. I could quit anytime. But they said in Alcoholics Anonymous, are you happy about being sober? And I thought, you must be on drugs. You're not maybe drinking, but you're on some heavy medication. And I seen people that were getting better, and they were transforming in front of me. Now I moved from Toronto or the North Bay to Toronto, where I was working and living, and I was 9 months sober, and I had a job to go to on a hydro dam outside of Thunder Bay in the Midwest, north in Canada. And so they said, don't make any major decisions in your sobriety, don't in the first year. And I thought, oh, I can't go to the job because that's a major decision. Well, my boss said, if you don't go, you're fired. And I laugh at it now. I'm going because I need the work and need the money. And I ended up running that job at 23 years old. And I had a fellow alcoholic that was probably 45 years old. And we worked together on the job. And so we would have meetings on the job site. And he was struggling at that time when I first met him. And there was a meeting 20 minutes, 10 minutes away from where I was living, and we would have meetings, and there was only two alcoholics in that little town. So when I came along, they said, oh my God, we got a live one. We got somebody to work with. And being 9 months sober, I knew what was happening, and I just share this because we're at a men's meeting, but we would have a spiritual meeting happen, and what talked about our alcoholism and stuff, and then all the guys would say, well, now we can go to the strip joint. I'm going, huh? But in those days, I went to the strip joint, and that time, that in my sobriety, I went to the strip joint with the guys, and I remember sitting there, and she was a beautiful young woman, of course, and I was stuck behind a post for some reason, and I had to keep looking, and I had to work to look, and I realized I came to that I didn't have to go there anymore. You know, it was old habits, old thinking, and that I made a change to stop going to the strip joints. Now, there's so many other places and things to do, and so I just share that because it was like, yeah, after an AA meeting, we went to the strip joint, and so that was the beginning of changing for Peter. The job finished, and my girlfriend at the time, I was living with the she was traveling through the States and Minneapolis and down but she was traveling anyways. We hooked up and we moved to St. Catharines, the Niagara area. She had a job to come to, and so I followed her to the Niagara area. Now they don't have too many high rises here, so I had to make some changes on a business sense, and there wasn't much work then. In 1978, 79, 1980, there was the interest rates went up to 23%. The economy wasn't good, so I went back to school and I finished my education because I didn't have my diplomas, and so I was able to do that sober. Go back to school, and I found out I did well, but I knew I wasn't going to be a brain surgeon. I knew that, but I ended up working as a carpenter, and that's my go-to. And so I was able to go to my meetings and get my medicine because I was unemployed. I was able to go to one and two meetings a day. I was in early sobriety, and I needed to get have. That's where I felt where I got my medicine. That's what I'm trying to say is that I knew I needed to be around some people that were positive. They were going through a lot of negative things, of course. I had lost no wife, no kids, no material stuff, but I lost Peter. And when you lose your mind and soul, there's nothing left really. Now I know guys that have they have everything, but how can you be so rich and be so poor? And that's how I relate my alcoholism that yes, you can have everything, but how, are you sober? Are you of sound mind and body? And you can't buy sobriety. I found out it's not a commodity that you can go to the store and do treatments and that you're all healed. It's not that way. I know that. But I was 9 months sober when I moved down to the Niagara area, and I was struggling, not with my drinking, but with my thinking, because I didn't know that I had a resentment towards God, like I had mentioned. And, they're supposed to pray for the people that you hate. And what do you, how do you do that? You pray for God or pray to God? So I was stuck. And, but I knew that in those days, Star Wars just came out, and it was Darth Vader and all the boys, and it was the good and the evil. And there is good in the world, but there's also evil. And I've seen both sides of that. And so with that, I seen the force in the world as being a little more positive, and that I had to hit the bottom sober. And emotionally and mentally and spiritually, I hit another bottom. And I had to ask the big guy for help. And something happened to me that night. I stopped fighting. I were rebellious to the end. And but anyways, I had the best sponsor. I had the best group. I went to meetings every day, but I still had that inner turmoil, irritable discontent. And so I had to reach out again. So we have spiritual awakening, and again, the world didn't change, but I had to change. At that time, I had been living with this girl, woman, and decided to marry her, and we got married in the courthouse in Welland, there was no shotgun. She wasn't pregnant, but I wanted to make it. I made a decision about who I wanted to be with, and we've been together for 47 years now. With the same woman. And so that's a miracle. And I also put a plug in for Al-Anon. She's an Al-Anon member. She goes to her meetings regularly. She doesn't drink. She's not an alcoholic, but she chooses the lifestyle because it is a lifestyle being sober. And I know we wouldn't be together today. I know that today if we weren't working the program to the best of our ability. It's not the best of your ability. If you worked my program, you might get drunk. Because some people want to go to a meeting once a week. I still go on a regular basis because I can, not because I have to. And the doors were open for me when I came here, and they're still open. Our group held the meetings right through the pandemic. We did the protocol, we had the doors open, and there weren't so many groups that were open. Yeah, here in Canada, but there was one in Niagara Falls, and it was on Lundy's Lane, that church stayed open through the whole pandemic and was sold just after the pandemic opened, and everything opened up, so there was God working. Like the guy that owned the church was had five bars in town, and he was became a Christian, and he wasn't an alcoholic, he said, but anyways, that's that God working, as I understand it. And I got married. I was 6 years sober. My first daughter was born. She's 40 years old now. My youngest daughter just had 37. She just had a baby boy or a baby girl 2 weeks ago out in Calgary. The She had a 1 year old a year before. Now I'm starting to reap the benefits in the sense that my kids didn't need me to, they didn't need my alcoholism or drug addiction. They have their own problems just being kids. And so being sober, I was able to participate. And I've never had a steady job in the, I'll be 46, I was 46 years sober December. And I've never had a steady job in the 46 years, but I've been able to work. You know, most alcoholics are entrepreneurs in many degrees, and I retired, I guess, but I still work a little bit today. And I start, like I mentioned, I started playing hockey again after 20 years. I played for 20, didn't play for 20, and now I'm playing again for a couple months, old timers hockey. And it's like, at 52 years old, I bought a motorcycle. I got a driver's license to drive a motorcycle. And I drove motorcycle as a kid, but no license, no insurance, never owned a bike, but always rode a bike. And I'm not a biker, but I love riding my bike. And that's where I get my prayer and meditation happening, where I can just ride. I don't ride with a lot of people. I'm still self-centered that way. I want to go my path, you know. And I jokingly say it's too tough being cool. You know, I have a Kawasaki, and it's a very simple bike, and so being sober, I can participate, be part of. And I also mentioned that I fall down sober sometimes, you know, with my thinking. And I sometimes my mom, she when she passed away, they had her on Oxycontin at 88 years old. And I wanted a freaking snap. I'm like, what the hell are they giving a woman 88 years old Oxycontin? And she was in a bad spot. You know, she hurt her shoulder, but it was just like, I could feel her pain that she was not doing well that way. But the idea is, I'm trying to say, is that I had a bit of a resentment, but I couldn't hold that. I'm not hardwired to hold on to resentment today. And that I see my grandchildren getting mad. They get mad, but they let it go. They haven't learned to hone resentment. And so I don't know. I'm rambling, but I just know that my higher power has humor, puts all of us together here this morning, and that we would never drink together. I know that, but we could be sober together. And so on. If you're ever in the Niagara area, my group is Saturday night, 7:30. East End group, and the doors are open for you if you ever want to come up and join us. And thank you for allowing me to share. Hopefully you got something. If not, that's okay too. And that's anyways, thank you very much. Thank you.